Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Before I get to today's rock star guest, I've had him on before. Just want to draw attention to my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. We've got 270 plus episodes of really inspirational people doing amazing things. I really urge people to go over there, check it out, or check it out wherever you get your podcast. I will also urge people to go into Apple and give some love there, ratings and review. It helps elevate the popularity of the show. There's so many pods out there, and people need to hear the people like I have on today and their story, because we all need to be inspired, including myself. Also, you can find the wonderful NFL film Searching for the Summit, which won a Best Picture Emmy Award last year, of my epic journey going up and down Mount Everest and all the other drama that took place with that. But there was a button that magically takes you straight to the NFL 360 film, which is 30 minutes long. It's pretty cool. And then finally, we continue to raise money for Amelia's Everest, which goes directly to Higher Ground, which is a charity here in Sun Valley, New York, and LA, about empowerment of other people. We're going to get into that today with my guest. He knows a thing or two about that. But anyways, if you want to make a donation, please go through there. 100% of all proceeds go directly to that organization. And most of it, ironically, goes to military people who have had some pretty serious traumatic injuries, not only trauma to the head and PTSD, but also limbs being blown off and trying to recover from that. So it's very important. Ironically, I want to jump into my guest now. His name is Nate Boyer. Nate, how are you doing?
I'm good, Mark. How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. Last time I saw you was at the Super Bowl, but the reason why I said ironically is because, of course, you were a Green Beret for a number of years, 8 years, I think it was, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you know, we're going to lead up to this movie that you just got done. It might have been your first one. I know you've appeared in other films, but the first one that you wrote, you directed, and you're really had a lot of control over all this, but let's just go back to kind of where you sit today in the really foundation of what you've become, starting with probably trying to find yourself in some way and then ending up with some structure by being in the military. What did that do for you? I mean, if you were to sum it up in a paragraph, what would that look like?
Oh man. I mean, you know, the military, it's funny. Like, I think a lot of people assume, especially parents, you know, I think that maybe their child needs this kind of structure or direction. A lot of people that served before would maybe kind of recommend it to a lot of people because of what it did for them. I didn't really have any of that. Like, not that my parents were anti-military or whatever, but they were very much like they weren't in the service themselves. Both my grandfathers were in World War II, but they weren't necessarily ever pushing me in a certain direction or thought that I needed anything. I think they were worried about me because in my late teens, early 20s, I didn't go to college. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I didn't really have a sense of direction. I was kind of just bouncing around odd job to odd job, having a good time doing it. You know, worked on a fishing boat, went to firefighter school for a few months, and then realized that wasn't for me yet to kind of, you know, grow up. I wasn't quite ready. I was 18, 19 when these things are happening. And then 9/11 happened when I was 20. And even then, while a lot of people were joining the military at that time, a lot of people my age were, you know, signing up, leaving college, leaving jobs they had, you know, enlisting before their second semester of high school or whatever it was, so that as soon as they graduated, they'd be off. For me, it was like, I don't know yet. I see why, and I had that interest, but it didn't lead me to that place quite yet. Not until I was 23 years old, and I ended up doing some relief work over in Africa, in the Darfur region between Chad and Sudan. And that really changed my life, that trip, that opportunity to go volunteer, even though it was only for, you know, a couple of months. The perspective I gained, and also the appreciation for what we had here, and the realization that most people don't and will probably never have that, made me want to fight for them, fight for those that couldn't, that can't fight for themselves, and sort of find a sense of purpose and be meaningful and feel like what I did on a daily basis made a difference, because I didn't feel that way before. And then once I went into the Army and into basic training, it's like structure is from day one, it's all about that. You know, it's all about like attention to detail, all the little things matter. And if you can't learn to fold your socks or your, you know, make your bed a certain way, you're certainly not gonna, you're certainly gonna struggle with when their bullets are flying around you, maintaining that, that sort of military bearing, the awareness, doing the little things to make sure that you're keeping each other safe. Like, it's all about those little things, which I think relates in a lot of ways to preparation for anything, that's of great challenge, whether it be playing in the NFL, summiting Everest, performing brain surgery, you know, whatever it is. So like I found the value of that structure and much, you know, kind of later in life. And I didn't, of course you sort of hear those things before you join, but you don't really understand at what level, at least for me, until I was sort of thrust into it. So not only basic training to be, you know, in the Special Forces, a Green Beret, all that stuff. It certainly was, not something I was fully prepared for, but I had a bit of an idea of what I was going to be encountering, and it helped me. It helped me throughout the rest of my life. I mean, I still got a lot of life left to live, but because of that time, I prioritization and responsibility and preparation, all those things that I didn't put a lot of stock in, they're like the lifeblood of how I operate now, you know?
Yeah, I do know. And I know it because my athletic past, playing at the University of Washington under a very structured coach and in the NFL, which has led me into the business things that I've been involved in. And certainly with mountain climbing around the world, it takes a certain discipline to be able to take on those things. And with actually daily discipline to have that commitment to the detail that, like you said, is very applicable to other things you have done. And again, I don't want to spend too much time on this because we did this on 100 episodes ago, I think, after we came off Kilimanjaro together. But, you know, that then led to the, and maybe this is more of a commentary on my side, this led to this really interesting football career you ended up having late in your 20s at the University of Texas. You became the starting long snapper. You played a lot, which then led to this NFL experience that you've had. And it's just amazing to me to see how much, you know, that, how much just you stepping into the fear and you stepping into the things you really didn't know and learning how to do things that you hadn't even done in high school, that has had this long tail effect for you in all these things that you have done. So then you and I will just touch on this for a second. So, you know, again, circling back into kind of this whole community activation and understanding there's a higher cause why we're here on this earth. And then you come together with Chris Long, my former teammate, Howie Long, who I know is in your movie. We'll talk about that in a minute. But Howie's son, Chris, you had a nice, great, phenomenal career, really, in the NFL. Won a couple Super Bowls, happened to pick the right teams. But you two came together to create this organization called Water Boys, which was really kind of bringing this whole idea of military people together with former NFL people. And at the end of the day, we're both kind of looking for like what's next and how do you evolve out of your career when you've been doing something that you love and you kind of drive off the end of the cliff. And so that experience for me down in Kilimanjaro, we happened to be in the first class. This was back in like 2016, 17, something like that.
17,
and here
yeah.
we are. Yeah. And here we are now. And you guys are still going at it full steam. What is your involvement now with that? Are you still going down there and climbing every year?
I haven't since 18. So it's been a while. It'll be 5 years this year since I've done it. But I think depends on the schedule. I'm going to try to do it again because I miss it. I want to get back up there. I've got a couple, every year it seems, I've got a couple buddies that make it on the roster you know, and they're like, are you coming? You got to go. I'm like, I need to, though. I definitely need to. I miss it. I got into trail running a bit this last year, ran my first 50K.
Wow.
And so kind of got back out there. It's different than obviously, climbing. You're not in quite the elevation, but I was actually signed up to do the Leadville 100 this year. And I booked a job on this, hosting this show that took about a month to shoot, and we were down in Panama, and I just couldn't swing it, unfortunately. So I missed out, but because of all of that, it's like, it's got me back on the trails, you know, and the Kilimanjaro is just a lot longer trail, a lot steeper at times. But it's still, you know, same kind of ballpark, but yeah, like you said, finding continued purpose was a big part of that after the military. Like, we talked about what led into it, you know, and feeling like I wanted to, or we all want to be a part of something, making a difference in other people's lives and all that. But when you actually get the opportunity to do it and you feel purposeful, and you can also do it while pursuing passions and things that you love to do and challenging yourself, it's just a great marriage. And so getting that opportunity to meet Chris, first of all, literally the day after I got cut is when we got connected. I got a call from him. I was in training camp in the preseason with the Seahawks after playing at Texas, and just played in one preseason game. And then the next round of cuts came along, my number got called, and that was it. And it was all good. I was grateful to get that shot, but immediately I'm like, all right, now what do I do? Military's over, football's over. I've lost my uniforms. What's next? And Chris called me and told me about Water Boys and what they were doing to bring clean water to East Africa through, some of these NFL players that were, official water boys for these teams. And he was like, originally that goal was 32 wells to represent the 32 teams. They've passed that long ago. And now I don't know what the new goal is, but it's with Chris, he'll just keep on setting them, which is great. But he said, what can we do to bring in the veteran community to what I'm doing here, if that's something of interest to you? And I said, man, well, I know we love a good challenge, and, you know, we want to be a part of continued service too. What if we get together some NFL players, current and former, and some veterans, you know, and we'll go climb Mount Kilimanjaro together, raise awareness for what's going on, you know, 19,340 feet below where we'll be, where there's, a lack of clean water and resources. And he thought that was really cool. And that first year I went up just with one other veteran who was an amputee, and we went out there. That was the first time I'd been there and, you know, got to climb and all that. And then, so that next year you were in that first big class. No, I know you'd already done Kilimanjaro before, yeah. Right? Prior.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So you had that experience as well under your belt. And I'd done it once, and Chris had done it once, but most of the other group, I think the rest of the group was all their first time.
Yeah.
But that was a really special trip. And we raised a lot of money. You know, I know we were in the six figures because we dedicated at least a couple of wells, if not three wells, from that trip. And then they've done it every year since then. And it's been quite a really cool journey with that. But yeah, you touched on something about, you briefly touched on it about the, my time in the military and then football and challenges, but also like when I think of what I'm doing now. Oh, you touched on it when you mentioned Howie and you said the movie. Yeah. Talking about the movie up, like that's something that I'm, you know, working on now and passionate about now, storytelling. And, I'll tell you, being around a movie set, a film set, you know, even in the narrative space where it's scripted and it's a lot more, you have a lot more somewhat control over the story and when you're shooting and what you're shooting. It's a little different than documentary. It's still in some ways like a military training operation, not a combat operation, of course, nobody's shooting at you, but like, things change, weather affects what you're doing. You have to be flexible. There's all these different departments and people in charge in different areas, and you have to be communicating effectively with them. And as a director, you have to communicate your vision appropriately and efficiently to the rest of the crew. and then let them be creative. Don't micromanage, like let them take their piece of the pie and make the best thing they can make. And then you've got to deal with, a budget and sudden change, you know, and being flexible, but also being authoritative. It's really interesting, but it's something that I've found helps me feel like I'm climbing a mountain, so to speak, you know, where you get that rush. I mean, not that being at the summit isn't an unbelievable feeling, but for me, it really is the course of finding that summit that I remember. It's the discovering what that thing is, the new creative endeavor, and then pursuing it and learning it and failing at it. And like that whole journey, that's what makes me feel alive. You know, I mean, I would imagine coming up to Everest, I don't know, but some of those moments where that voice in your head is telling you to quit, or your body feels like, I don't know if I can continue, yet something in your spirit perseveres and just keeps going. And somehow you take that next step, and then you take that next step. Like that's that feeling of, I am not letting this defeat me. Like that, those are the moments in life I'm trying to continually relive because they make me feel alive, you know?
Yeah. Well, this picture right here is me on top of Everest, and I was probably at my worst moment right here when this should be my best moment because of all those things. You know, I was 9-10 hours into it, and I still had another 9-10 hours to go. And I knew I had some very, very, very difficult things I still had to navigate and go through. But I think one of the things that makes you, you know, who you are and why you've achieved like the way you've achieved is because you have this thing called the power of curiosity. To me, yeah, I've been around you. I've spent time with you. So I had the Super Bowl last year, but you know, really on that Kilimanjaro trip, I've also been up to your gym with Glazier, which we'll talk about in a minute. But again, it's just like you're taking a step back and you're trying to see a path, and you're asking yourself, why does this work and how do you do that, and going through all those different things. And I think when you really dig into that and start going down and peeling the layers, then these answers start to bubble up. And, you know, I prepared for 2 years for Everest, and all that preparation still didn't line me for every single thing that happened up there. But, you know, when I was up there, it was like, okay, I got to figure it out. Okay. It's 0 degrees at night for 2 months. Like, how do you deal with that? And how do you get through that? And how do you stay mentally focused and all these different things? And I think, you know, through this different training that you've done, plus just who you are, the combination of those two things, it's no surprise to me that you continue to achieve. Now, after we came back from Kilimanjaro, I was living in LA at the time, and now in Sun Valley, Idaho, and you had come together with Jay Glazier, and Glazier's got this workout studio, and you'd seen this need of, or this void where there's all these military vets that are coming out of the military with no purpose, no direction, no structure, and many of them suicidal and things like that. And so you guys created this place, this safe place where they could go up, they could work out in this gym in Hollywood. And also you invited former athletes. I know a lot of them were NFL players because of Glazier's relationship with being on the NFL on Fox, and with your experience. I was fortunate to be up there a couple of times and go through kind of this cross training 1 hour thing. And then afterwards, us all sitting down together in a big circle. And I'm not sure what you call it, the circle of truth or whatever, but people just freely, you know, you could go around the circle and share a story or not share a story. But it blew my mind away to listen to some of these stories. Like, they were just happy to be there because 3 days ago they were ready to end it. And I can only imagine the amount of stories and probably the inspiration for this new movie MVP that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I mean, we ended up back when you came that initial time, we were still pretty early on. We hadn't named the circle. We didn't know what it was, but organically it became the huddle, which makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what we call it. And as you said, yeah, we train for 30, 45 minutes, nothing too hard, just get a sweat going, something that everybody can do, but we got to do it together. And enough to kind of build a bit of a bond and make people feel comfortable in the room. Hey, nobody quit here. So we're all, you know, we all got through this workout today, and now we're huddling up. And It's an open forum, you know, peer-to-peer coaching session, if you want to call it. Kind of like some of the conversations I'm sure you had in the locker room at times, you know, you get done with the day of practice and you may have never talked to this person before, but their locker is a few away from yours. And all of a sudden you're just shooting the breeze about something and realize you got a lot in common and maybe somebody struggling with something or whatever. And you kind of talk through it. I mean, it's different. Every locker room is different. It's different at every level too. I mean, college is very different than the NFL and all that stuff. But I noticed in my short time playing football that a lot of those conversations were very similar to the ones I had around a fire pit on a rooftop in Iraq. It's like, we're not talking about the battle we just encountered. We're talking about life back home and dreams and, you know, what I want to do in the future and what I'm frustrated with, you know, and what I can't get past or whatever it is. Because sometimes a lot of the things that's shared in that circle and that huddle has nothing to do with post-traumatic stress or, you know, so it has nothing to do with, you know, feeling like you were a bust as an athlete and it didn't work out or whatever that is. So it's really eye-opening to kind of hear those stories and see that, but there's just such a mutual respect between athletes and veterans. Both of them have to sacrifice quite a bit to be elite. Of course, you know, going to war and playing professional sports are very different things. We would never compare that, but losing that uniform and identity and trying to find yourself and, you know, honestly find your next summit can be really hard, you know, for a lot of people. To feeling like I've peaked and I'll never be great again is a very common thing. And those are words that were literally spoken by Tony Gonzalez in one of our huddles, probably the greatest tight end of all time, if not one of them, 17-year Hall of Fame career. And, you know, he retired and had a broadcasting career in front of him. He's a good looking dude. You know, he wants to work and he wants to be an actor as well. Kind of the world is his oyster situation. He's only 37. But what he felt inside was, yeah, maybe I've got all these things outside, but I don't believe that about myself. And I feel like I've peaked and that's like a scary feeling, you know. And for him to share that in the huddle and to have these veterans who many of them, like you said, have, you know, attempted suicide in the past or just really struggle with letting go of the past and kind of moving on. To hear someone like that, that you're just, you think, well, he's got it all. I mean, you know, beautiful family, plenty of money in the bank account. I mean, this was, you know, he's the one percenter of the NFL.
He's the 1% of the 1%.
Exactly. I mean, add everything except a Super Bowl, you know. There's always something with all these guys, every single one of them. It's like Randy Couture's thing is he didn't make the Olympic wrestling team, but he's the 6-time heavyweight champion of the world, you know. But to him, he's like, I'm a failure, you know, that was my dream. And it's like, wow. So everybody feels that, you know, and we're all connected in that way. We're always going to have that thing, no matter how accomplished you are, that you feel like you could have done more, you could have gave more, you could have done better. And I'll tell you, a ton of veterans feel that way. I mean, they'll never remember how many people they potentially saved. It's the ones they lost and what they failed in their mind, failed to do enough of or correctly. And, you know, I zigged when I should have zagged, and you know, they'll just hang on to that forever. And it's unfair to themselves. And it's challenging. And it's just something we have to learn to sort of live with and recognize and not let it get the best of us. Cause it's always, I feel like some of those things are just going to always be there at some level, and that's okay. But if we're aware of it, you know, and we're aware that it's not the reality of who I am, it's just something I feel sometimes, then we can move past it, you know, and probably help it propel us into greater things. Because, you know, when we, at least with me, when I feel like I didn't win, you know, or I didn't succeed at the level I wanted to, it just motivates me to push that much harder into the next thing and find another way to succeed or win, you know?
Yeah, no, I love that. And, you know, going back to Tony Gonzalez, you know, this for you people looking at watching this on YouTube right now, this is my, you can't really see it, but this is a picture of me on stage accepting the Emmy for this best picture of Searching for the Summit. And it really has nothing to do with me climbing the mountains. Yes, I was on Mount Everest and there's a lot of scenes and footage, but it's really about me being in a rut and finding my way out, you know, kind of to your whole point, right? What that was all about. So I'm researching this movie. I knew it was coming out. You know, you're a buddy, you're a friend. We've climbed together. And I was so happy to see how you kind of merge in these two worlds to create this film, which is so important. And then I think, correct me if I'm not right or wrong here, but I think Sylvester Stallone is the executive producer, which I don't even know exactly what that means, but somehow or another, he's involved in this whole film that you were able to write and direct and everything else and get all these other actors involved. But how in the heck did you ever, how does that work? I mean, how do you pull, you know, Sly into this thing?
Yeah, well, so Stallone had been to an MVP session. So MVP, you know, as you said, stands for Merging Vets and Players. I co-founded it with Jay Glazer back in 2015. And now we've got 8 chapters around the country. So we're about to have our 7th anniversary. We're in LA, Vegas, Chicago, Atlanta, New York, Seattle, Dallas, and Phoenix. Wow. Vetsandplayers.org is the website if anybody wants to check that out further. But Sly had come to Jay's gym, Unbreakable, which you've been to, and he trained there for 6 months or something like that. He was preparing for something. And before he moved out to Miami now, but he used to live out here. And Jay was always telling him about MVP. You got to check out MVP. You know, it's this charity. And Sly was like, oh, you know, of course, I'm sure he gets hit up a lot from a lot of organizations, you know. And he was like, finally, he was like, one of these nights, I'll come in tonight. You know, don't go telling a bunch of people because I don't want a bunch of people showing up just because I'm there. Well, of course, word got out. And there's like, you know, normal session, we've got 30, 40, sometimes 50 people. There's like 100 people there.
Yeah. It's a small space too.
It's a small gym. Yeah. It suits about, I mean, from a training aspect, you got 30 people in there. You're plenty full.
Yeah.
So he's in there, everyone's working out. I mean, he's not working out with us, but he's hanging out, you know, kind of watching everybody. And then afterwards we move to the huddle and, you know, to kick things off, Jay, you know, asks if Sly wanted to say anything. And he's like, no, I'll just, you know, I want to hear you guys. And so he sit there and listened to a lot of these stories and these people talking and being as vulnerable as they were and just as open as they were. He was kind of blown away, like, wow, this is crazy. You know? So he went into this thing with the the misunderstanding that he was going to go there and kind of give a speech, you know? And instead he's like hearing this stuff. And he's like, oh, I don't need to give a speech at all. And eventually one of the vets just said, you know, Sly, I just want to say, like, thank you for coming. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, that's one of the reasons I wanted to be in the military was Rambo. I know that maybe sounds cheesy, but like that was you. It was that character is one of my heroes, you know. And Stallone says, well, let me tell you a quick story about Rambo. You know, in the book, First Blood, Rambo dies. He's actually sort of put down almost like a dog at the end of this. And it's a, you know, he's a Vietnam veteran that struggles with post-traumatic stress and coming home and disrespected and just feels like he can never, you know, he's not going to fit in anymore and kind of goes off the deep end. And he was pitched this is after the success of Rocky. He's pitched this character in this movie and he's like, well, look, I think it's an important story to tell, but there's no hope in it. You know, he's just killed at the end. And he's like, if you guys change it, if you're willing to change it and let the man live and at least have a glimmer of hope there, I'll consider it. And so they did. They changed the script so that Rambo lived at the end. And of course, they make four more Rambos. So for the studio, it was a good business decision as well. Yeah. But he was like, I wanted to play a Green Beret so bad. And I wanted to play this character in this Vietnam veteran story. I thought it was so important. But I also just thought it was important that this person had a chance. You know, we believed in this person moving forward and there was going to be a future afterwards. And now I'm sitting here listening to you guys. And it's like, this is a lot of this is the story, the feelings that the character John Rambo had, you know. And I had become friends with his producing partner, a guy named Braden Aftergood. He used to work at Peter Berg's production company where I interned. Peter Berg did Friday Night Lights and Lone Survivor.
Love that. Yeah. Love those shows. Yeah. He's great.
Yeah. And so I'd gotten to know Braden, and as luck would have it, Braden and Stallone came together to create Balboa Productions. And I was in contact with Braden. I said, hey, look, Sly's been to MVP before. And just so you know, I'm working on a script. I want to tell the story of how we started. And he said, well, send it to me. So he sent it to me. He sent back a ton of notes and said, it needs a lot of work, but I think there's some promise here. And so I worked through it, and eventually Stallone just said, hey, like, you know, put my name on it. Like I got a lot going on. I don't have a ton of bandwidth here, but if my name's going to help this thing get made, then use it. And he hasn't asked for anything, you know, it's been amazing, like, just to see that. But he did. I mean, and that's a lot of the reason that a lot of these people read it. Some of the other actors involved and all that was because it had Stallone's name on it. And once they read it, they were like, oh, wow, this is actually something I am passionate about and can get behind. And I think it's really important. You guys are telling your own stories, because we've got, I mean, every veteran portrayed on screen is played by a vet. Most of them are MVP members. All the athletes, well, many of the athletes, as you mentioned, Tony Gonzalez, Randy Couture, Strahan and Howie Long have a cameo. Jared Bunch, first round draft pick by the Giants, played fullback for about 4 years for an injury. Ended his career. He's in the film. Rich Eisen and Jay Glazer are in the film, you know, playing themselves. So all that sort of came together, and with that authenticity, and we made this thing. We shot it in the middle of COVID, figured it out with very limited resources, budget wise, but a lot of passion and support from the league. And from just countless others around the Los Angeles area. We filmed on location in the gym, in the veterans homeless shelter, where a lot of these vets were living. It's a very like real product, and something that took me a long time to appreciate, because I was so afraid throughout the whole process that I was screwing this thing up, doing our story justice. But the first time I watched it in the theater was at the Super Bowl this year. That week we had a screening, and to see the vets and the athletes, you know, Kenny Mayne and Sean O'Hara walked out of the theater in tears. And I was like, all right, like this is, it resonates with the people that it matters to me. You know, mainly it's the members of MVP and the people that understand our story and kind of where we come from. That's who I really wanted it to hit with. And fortunately that, you know, we're out now and anybody can watch it. It's on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, other streaming video on demand services. And so I encourage anybody to watch it, share about it, learn more about MVP through vetsandplayers.org. But really sharing this movie and getting it out there is important. You know, it tells our story. It's how it all started. It's about a homeless Marine and an NFL player, first year out of the league, who meet and realize they're going through the same things and kind of bring this MVP idea into existence.
So again, let's go back to this film, because I want to relate it to what you just went through. I'm not a writer, I'm not a director, I'm not a producer, I'm not an actor, like all the things you are, I'm not, right? I just happened to meet the fascination of NFL films, that they wanted to do this story on me. They came over here really not knowing, other than just there's Mark's gonna go try to take on Mount Everson, tried to become the first NFL player to do this, right? That was really the only notion. And so many other things came out of it. And the thing that blew me away after seeing the final product was that I had no clue about, you know, we'd go up and we'd shoot for hours on this ridgeline, and I was climbing, and I was doing this, and Jim Mora was also involved in some of it, and, you know, being interviewed. And what it ultimately got down to is that the way that they were able to have a vision in mind of what the story was going to be about, and then edit it in a way that made sense and it was compelling. And then the music, there were so many elements. I had no clue that when they were here in January of 2021, the film didn't come out till September of 21. And in between that time, they put this whole masterpiece together. Like what they were filming at the time could have any end result of what ultimately came out, which was the best picture, you know? It just did not connect. And so it just, what I'm trying to say is that so much of the film happened once the actual footage was in the can. And then the people, as you know, because you've been through it, you know, on the, you know, the cutting room and the music and the sound and having stakes for every single scene that is in there means right. so much in trying to come up with this finite time. In my case, you know, it was 29 minutes or something, you know, just under the 30 minute clock. In your case, you go on for a couple of hours, I think an hour 52 or something is your film. So making it, I'm sure if you could have had your way, it could have been 4 hours because there's so many amazing stories to tell. Right.
Well, the first cut was about 2 hours and 48 minutes and it was way.
So there's the point. Right. So the discipline of continuing to whittle and whittle and whittle and whittle. And so making sure that every scene just again has those high stakes, which ultimately come together and bring something which Kenny Mayne can walk out of a theater crying because he's so compelled at what you have created.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, man. And I mean, you get it. You definitely get it. And it's like, it's hard to make those cuts because you know, when it's your story or you feel so connected to it, you're like, well, that's an important piece of it too. And it is, not to say it's not, but it's a matter of like, what is the most important, you know, and does this part of the story serve the greater story in the best way? Because making sure that just like the mission in the military, the mission always has to come first. Mm-hmm. Making sure that the movie always comes first, no matter what, you know, and that comes with tough decisions, and sometimes it comes with cutting your niece and nephew out of the movie, which I had to do. you know what I mean? And some other great actors, and it wasn't anything to do with their performance at all. It just wasn't, you know, it wasn't serving the ultimate story, final cut that we ended up with. What's most important is the movie and the audience, and making sure that you captivate them and keep them, and they're interested and they're connected to it, and they don't want to, you know, they don't want to check out and look at their phone, you know, or whatever that is. Like, how do you keep them fully engaged? It's really hard. And I mean, the editing of this, a lot of it was because we just didn't have the resources and the money, but it took months and months and months because when people were available, because they weren't working on a bigger project that was paying them a lot better, I had to take those 2 weeks here, 3 weeks there, get in the room with them and like, let's just hammer this out for as much time as we can, because I know you got to jump on this other project next. And but it was, you know, throughout that whole thing, from the sound, you know, the final sound mix and everything, the people, the level of people that were working on it because of the story, and that were you know, doing it at such a cut rate for what they normally get, it was awesome. I mean, we were very lucky to have all that. It's the only way we could have got it done. I definitely don't want to make another one at that level. Not that I need tens of millions of dollars, but like, you know, when you're dealing with just hundreds of thousands of dollars and not many of them, it's tough. I'll just leave it at that. It makes it infinitely harder to, you know, just stretch what you got every day. So from the beginning of filming it to its final release was a two-year process, you know. That's a long time, you know.
So how do you finance that? Like, you know, again, there's a lot of people out there. I think one of the things you've done really smartly is you want to be an actor. And so it seems to me, at least, like, especially with how many levels of access, you know, from the Amazon Prime to Netflix to all these other streaming services, that if you want to be an actor, the best way to do is to try to do everything you can to control that, right? Which is what you did, which is basically be the actor, the director, the executive. You know, you were wearing 15 different hats, but then you control the project, right? So, like, in this case, does a studio back you on this, or do a group of investors back you on this, or how does that whole thing work?
I mean, it depends on the project. I mean, this is an independent project. You know, if it's a studio film, it's no longer really independent. That's sort of the defining characteristic, I think. Independently financed, two individuals specifically, and myself, kind of put up the funds. And like I said, it wasn't a ton. So for them, it was lower risk. It was, you know, hey, both of these people that jumped in with me just were passionate about MVP, the organization. They're like, tell a good story, tell it right, do the best that you can. If I see a return, great, but I'm not stressed on that. And that takes a lot of pressure off me and everybody. But then also, like, to wear all those hats, part of it was, like, we definitely wanted to be able to dictate the narrative, but also I don't have to pay myself to produce, to co-write, to direct, to act. So we're saving so much, and it just goes back into the film, you know, and being able to use that in other places. Because all these other people as well, like the, all those names we listed before, they all worked for scale, which is very low, you know, in the hundreds of dollars, to work on this thing. Like they didn't ask for more. They didn't need more. They just were like, I'm in because of what it is. And thankfully you're only asking for 2 or 3 days of my time. So it's not too crazy. And there's not a ton going on right now in October 2020 with COVID and whatnot. So I'm in, let's go. And that's how that sort of came to fruition. But every movie's different. I mean, it's tough. I get pitched a lot of bigger ideas, you know, a lot of action-based stuff that's, you know, military stories, which I think are super important to tell accurately. But for me, like, that's a little tougher to get done, because then you're looking at, it's an 8-digit movie, you know, not a 6-digit movie. And those are just completely different worlds. And to do that right, you need those resources. And it is a greater risk. I think one day I'd like to get to that place to be able to tell films, stories like that. I mean, one of my favorite directors is a veteran himself. His name's David Ayer. He made Fury. I don't know if you ever saw Fury, but it's a really good movie. It's heavy. It's a World War II film, you know.
I saw it. It was insane.
Yeah. Brad Pitt, John Bernthal, Shia LaBeouf, you know, and others. And it's great. But, you know, that's a huge process to get to that point and to feel like you're ready to take on an endeavor such as that, completely different than this movie, where I think the independent world for me is makes sense right now, where it's a little, the stories are more contained. There's something I can absolutely relate to, and I'm kind of living in some ways right now. And I'll tell you, next time I direct something, I definitely don't want to play one of the leads. That was a great challenge to be on both sides of that. There's just, you're juggling chainsaws every day, and it just feels a bit overwhelming at times, but I think it was necessary for this project at the level we were at. This is my new mission. Like, the storytelling piece is really important, and I'm passionate about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, it's like you don't go from Little League to the NFL in one jump, right? You do that in iterations, and that's what you're talking about right now. The guy that's been on the podcast is Tom Arnold. Tom was in your film. What role did he have in your piece that you did? I haven't seen it. I actually am going to watch your movie tonight. Now that, because I know it was in the theaters, and I live in a small town, so we didn't have it here. Yeah, but right. Now that you just, you know, letting us know that you can see it on MVP on Prime, Amazon, I will download that tonight and watch it. But what role did Tom have with the film?
So Tom, I'd met Tom a few years prior, and you know, Tom's got a very interesting story. First of all, you know, he's from Iowa, small town guy himself. But also he lost a nephew of his, to suicide, and he was a veteran. And so when that happened in his life, he's always kind of had a great respect for the military and veterans, as a lot of people do, but it was different. It was a much closer connection for him. And he was just like kind of struck by that. And then understanding how common and often that happens, unfortunately. It's roughly 20 to 22 veterans a day across the country lose that battle back home. And he became very connected to that. And in our story, in the MVP film, that's a big part of it, because this unit that this Marine who's living in the shelter, the unit that he was in is 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines. On back-to-back deployments in 2007, 2008, they lost 29 guys to combat. And since then, since coming home in 2009, they've lost 56 now to suicide. And that battalion is maybe 1,000 guys at the most. It's not that big. So to put it in that perspective, you know, to think that, gosh, you know, over 5% of our unit is gone, 1 out of 20 or more than that of those people have taken their own life back home is staggering. You know what I mean? It's staggering. And so he was so connected to that because of that story and losing his nephew and understanding what that was like for the family, how it affected him and his family. He just wanted to be a part of it. And he was great. He was like, he literally was like, whatever role you want me to play, I'll help. I got you. Mm-hmm. He's like, you can. And so we ended up, as you'll see, you know, he it's kind of a perfect role for him because he's very funny. And it's sort of a bit of a comedic levity in the middle of the movie. And he's like a fantasy football analyst at, you know, at NFL Network. And the lead actor, Mo McCray, who plays Will Phillips, who he's first year out of the league and he's trying to find his footing. And then all of a sudden there's this opportunity to get into broadcasting potentially. And he's excited about that opportunity only to find out it's in the fantasy football world, which he has no interest in. You know, he's like, I know real football. I want to talk real football. I don't want to do this. And so these guys, you know, collide, and it's just another one of these getting your hopes up situations and it just not panning out how you expect it. And that's the story of a lot of us, you know, as we're transitioning and trying to find our footing.
Yeah, no, love that. All right, buddy, listen, let's just make sure everybody's clear. Where can people find you, number one?
I'm I have a website, NateBoyer.com, but also at NateBoyer37 on Twitter and Instagram. And MVP, Emerging Vets and Players, you can find us at vetsandplayers.org. If you have veterans or athletes in your world that you think could utilize our program or have any ideas on how you want to help us continue to grow, that would be great. And then the movie, at MVP the movie is our social media. But you can also see the film, and you should see the film on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, pretty much anywhere else that it, streaming video on demand, you're able to watch that now.
Love that. Love that. Proud of you too, man. You've come a long way and it's been fun to see your journey. So it's really cool. Anything that I can do to help you at any time, you just let me know. But on that note, thanks for coming on and sharing your story and continued success. And next time you have a film or you do something crazy, I will have you back on the show. So totally appreciate you.
Of course, brother. Appreciate you too. Love you, man. And can't wait to see you again. I'm sure I'll see you down in Phoenix this year.
Right on, right on. Okay. All right, everybody. There he is. The one, the only Nate Boyer. Thank you.